Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to the Castobrus podcast with a K, available on castobrus.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the podcast with a K. My name's Christian Corley, editor of Castobrus. With me is James McLean.
Hello.
And Brian Terranova's here too.
Hey!
Hi, how are you, Brian?
I'm here.
You are here. Or there, because you're never here.
That's barely true, here. I'm not here. Well, I'm here.
Yeah, you are there. Well, I'm here. Yeah. Actually, I think you'll find. Okay, so you've been away a couple of weeks, so you don't know anything that's going on in the world of Doctor Who, do you?
I know nothing, actually, that's going on in the world, period.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a blank slate right now, so.
Right, okay.
Good times, you know?
Yeah. Excellent. I'm not sure if it's good to be a blank slate or bad. James,
what say you? Probably bad.
I think Brian gets preferential treatment. I think he's the favourite.
What do you mean he's the favourite? The favourite
You asked how he was. You asked what he's doing. You've had a chat about what he's been up
to
the last 2 weeks.
I haven't got round to you yet, have I?
No,
I just brought you in.
That's what I mean. That's by the definition of preference, isn't it? Who do we prefer is the one we go to first. If there's two ladies in the room, the one that you shoot to first is the one that you're probably most likely after. It's not going to be the other one.
Well, it depends, doesn't it? Because the way my world works, I would always go for the one that I'm not expecting to be able to get anywhere with first, because I know that I'll end up with the other one.
Well, in your world, one of them will be a prostitute, won't it, if I recall correctly?
Oh, we're going back to the BBC tease.
Yes, I know.
I'll have to put a show note to that, won't I?
A little bit of a callback. Otherwise, people will actually think you generally have a bit of a prostitute thing going
on.
Like,
it's like an ongoing unfolding text, isn't it? Almost like a 50-year-old TV show called Doctor Who.
Okay, go with that.
Thanks, I will. And the great thing about Doctor Who isn't just that it's 50 years old, but that it's had loads of brilliant people in it. And often, and certainly in the old days, those brilliant people kind of didn't get perhaps the recognition that they might have been able to, or perhaps their agents weren't as clued into what they could have been doing to sell themselves. You know, there was the odd overseas appearance, you know, like Tom Baker in Remington Steele. Did you see that?
No.
I think it was Remington Steele.
Well, clearly you didn't see it then.
No, I've seen what I've seen on YouTube is a montage of Tom Baker,
right,
coming into these scenes through doors, and so the person who put it together, I'm gonna have to do a show note for this now as well, did a TARDIS sound effect just before he opened the door, because he still had the long curly hair and he was wearing a long coat. Brian, can you help me out here?
I believe it's that. I mean, I can do a quick double check, but I believe it is Remington Steele. I'm trying to think which other 80s show it would have been, but I believe it's that one.
I think it's Remington Steele. You know, Tom Baker, yeah, but many of the other older Doctor Who guys didn't really do so well overseas. But now it's completely mad. You've got David Tennant with his, although he failed with his sitcom, which a lot got blamed on his American accent, but there must be more to it than that. You can't just put everything on an accent. That aside, there's the Broadchurch remake, Grace Point. You've got Matt Smith in a couple of films. You've got Karen Gillan in a film and a sitcom. John Hurt's in films all the time now. Or not that he always was, but he seems to be getting a bit more focused, possibly because he's got a new younger audience through Doctor Who. It's kind of crazy. We did feature a list of these a couple of days ago with stars of Doctor Who are everywhere this summer. And, you know, there's good and there's bad. I fancy Oculus, although I really don't like horror films. But I'm really intrigued by the idea of Oculus. We were talking about Guardians of the Galaxy last week, weren't we, James?
Yeah, we were.
And you don't fancy it at all, do you?
No, I don't.
Brian, what about you?
I'm with James. I may go see it because I have, I have a mild curiosity about it. But I know nothing about the comic. You know, I'm sure, you know, since Marvel knows more about their stuff, they probably see the merit in making it. But to me,
I kind of hope they know more about their stuff than you clearly do.
I would hope so. Yeah. No, but I mean, it just seems to me like an odd choice with all the other kind of like titles and so on that they have at their disposal to come out with that one and still have it kind of linked to their Marvel Cinematic Universe that they're doing right now. But hey, maybe it'll make sense. Maybe it'll be really fun. Well, but the trailer just doesn't look too fantastic to me.
They had Fantastic Four, didn't they? And they somehow managed to fail with that.
Well, you got to remember that the thing is, Fantastic Four, X-Men, and Spider-Man are not part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe because they're outsourced to other production companies.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they're failing with them, but they can't do anything with them properly. So I guess that's why they got to go with things like Guardians of the Galaxy within their own actual cinematic universe. I don't know if you guys saw the new Spider-Man movie, but at the end credits, this isn't really a spoiler. At the end credits, there's a trailer for the X-Men movie, the new X-Men movie, and that's Sony and Fox. So maybe somehow the Marvel universes are finding a way to actually play nice and work together despite being with other production companies. So maybe some good stuff will come from it. Who knows? But yeah, I don't know. Friends I know who read Guardians of the Galaxy say it's fun, it's interesting. The movie trailer just doesn't look great to me. We'll see.
Guardians of the Galaxy, more like bottom of the barrel, Lixie.
I think it might surprise people, to be honest with you. I'd rather watch Guardians of the Galaxy than the DC one.
Bottom of the barrel, Lixie.
Oh, I'm with you there. I definitely would rather watch that over the DC stuff, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think you're right. It may surprise us. I may come out of it going, okay, that was fun. But, you know, I don't have any vested interest in them. You know, it's unlike Spider-Man or Iron Man or the Avengers to me, or even before with the X-Men, which unfortunately they kind of started to go downhill with that third one. Although the last one was pretty good, so hopefully this new one will be good. But I just think somehow it's there's no interest there. I really am just, since they've made it connected, I feel an obligation to watch it to see how it's connected, but I don't really know about it or care about it in a sense like I did the other characters that I think so far.
I think the klaxons which go off with it is that it's neither superhero, neither is it Star Wars. It's one of those odd sort of, as far as I understand, comic ranges which sort of flits between the two in a sort of combo of the of that sort of Marvel hybrid. And I think people, when they go to see sort of the sort of Marvel stuff, they expect the sort of contemporary superhero stuff set on Earth where the unusual are at odds with the normal around it. Or they like going to see things like Star Wars, where it's utterly divorced from Earth and everything and its own universe. And things like Guardians of the Galaxy, sort of, as far as I understand, sort of sits awkwardly between the two sort of genres. And I think that's probably why people are a bit like, well, I don't care, because it's not like Spider-Man and it's not really like Star Wars. It's, well, yeah. So I think the funny thing is that, you know, you say all these all these Doctor Who people getting into good stuff, but it is potentially good stuff, isn't it? I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy could totally and utterly bomb.
Well, Cameron's got the sitcom as well.
And that could be killed within a season, that could disappear.
Exactly,
which would be unusual.
Well, he got the go ahead from a pilot. But then on the other flip side, and you've already talked about flip sides, but then we've got the Postman Pat movie, which features David Tennant as a villain. And yes, dear listener, I just did say Postman Pat movie with David Tennant.
What the hell is that?
Postman Pat's a kids TV show. And it's a little kind of stop motion guy who's a postman and lives in a little village in Cumbria or Northumberland in the UK, around the Lake District kind of way. And he has a postmistress called Mrs. Goggins. He has a son called Julian, and he delivers posts and helps people out of their problems. And for some reason, it's been turned into a film. It's about 30 years old. It's been going for about 30 years. So they're kind of banking on kids and their parents going to see it for nostalgia reasons, I should think. But the trailer, I'll link to the trailer. We've got it on Cult Britannia, and it's kind of frightening, really.
Postman Pat. Or like bottom of the barrel-y Postman Patrick. No, I don't know. I mean, but all these things, I mean, sorry, but it's not a massive thing, is it, animated? I mean, so far as an actor's profile goes, as soon as you're doing voice work, it's never quite, even though it's not very fair, it's never got quite the profile. So I think what I'm saying is there's a lot of stuff out there, you know, for the big things, as we talked about last week, you know, with Matt Smith, with Terminator. Again, that could go down south very badly for him as well. You know, these are sort of big things, but they may go otherwhere. I have to say, I've been watching John Sim in Prey.
Yes,
and
I've
been really enjoying him in that. I mean, it's a bit of an odd show in itself, but he is very good in it. But I quite like John Sim. I like him. He's like the Martin Freeman, but with acting.
Height.
Has a bit of charm. Yeah, I don't know, Martin Freeman. He seems a very nice guy, and he does a very good role, as we said before, as Martin Freeman. But I just feel that John Sim is the level above. Do you ever get that? You think there's like there's grades of the same characters? Like, to me, Gene Hackman is a grade, and then you sort of Bill Murray might sit behind it. They sort of could play similar archetypes. Then at the very bottom, if you've got no one else, you've got James Belushi. Do you never see that sort of things? Like Michael Douglas, if you've got the money. Michael Douglas, you don't have the money for Michael Douglas, you might have to opt for Bruce Boxleitner. So similar sort of character sort of styles that would probably fit in either. No. Bruce Willis. No, Bruce Willis was about Jerry Doyle. I don't know. Didn't even get that? No, it's just me? Okay, fine.
I don't know. I always it's weird for me, and maybe it's the same thing, but for years, I always used to get very confused with Michael Douglas and Kurt Russell. I guess when I was younger or whatever, but they
get confused between Kurt Russell and Patrick Swayze.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, I don't know, but I do agree with what you're saying. I do agree that there are like varying degrees of actors where, like, you know, some of them are just like, yeah, that's the perfect one. That's what you want. You can't get that. Here's that next close enough kind of thing that can do it, kind of too.
Yes.
Kind of thing, and I don't know. Maybe not to poke fun at actors, but it's definitely a true thing out there.
I think we should poke fun at actors.
Let's do it. You know, honestly, though, thinking about Matt, Karen, and David all coming here after Doctor Who, the one thing I was noticing was it's very interesting that they all seem to be getting pretty much sci-fi or horror, unless they go to TV, in which case it seems to be some kind of sitcom. With the exception of now David Tennant is actually doing a remake of one of his own TV shows, which I'm sure John Sim, going back to him for a moment, is pretty ticked off about, considering his comments before were, America remakes everything I do. Why don't they just hire me?
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe they will for Prey.
Well, no.
That might go over there. No.
Maybe, you know, they won't, because it's kind of very similar to a certain TV series. Yeah.
Fugitive. Well, it is the, Fugitive in Manxland. So that's essentially it. It's very good.
Yeah, I haven't heard of this. So.
No, it's only three parts. The last part is actually tonight. We're recording on Monday. So, but yeah, it's been a laugh. It's got that sort of British darkness, but there's a certain sort of simplicity to the characterizations, which sort of levitates it a bit. Like the antagonist against John Sim, you know, they've made her as unlikable as possible, rather than try to. And so it sort of takes it away from being too dark, doesn't it, in a sort of weird way. I mean, she's just they've done it every way. No, not only is she not only does she sort of stalk her ex, not only has she screwed up this investigation and is fingering the wrong man, and beyond that, she eats lots of chocolate and looks a bit podgy, which of course on television is like the ultimate sin. You know, they've padded her out with unflattering.
There was actually a controversy about her being described like that, so you need to be careful.
Let me finish. They padded her out in clothes which make her look bigger, and then they give her chocolate. You notice that? I mean, the stuff she wears is very broad-shouldered and thick jackets, so they can sort of focus on this idea of creating this archetype, which no one could particularly like, which suits the show when you're meant to be liking John Sim. So in some ways, it becomes very pantomime in a very weird way, because normally the antagonist
without the twirly moustache
is without. I mean, take the future. I mean, let's take the remake of The Fugitive with Harrison Ford. You've got Tommy Lee Jones against him, who is actually quite a sympathetic character. You're meant to actually quite like his character. In fact, so much so they could do a spin-off of him. You know, so that's what they tend to do. But this doesn't do that at all. It tries to get this poor woman and screw her over from the audience perception on every front. Stalk her, bad at her job, after the wrong person, eats too much chocolate, looks a bit thick, a bit weighty in her clothes. You know, it's all these sort of really quite insidious ways to not like this person, which makes it kind of fascinating. You know,
well, I actually do like her. I think she's doing the actress really good, isn't she?
I think she is very good. And I'm wondering whether they're going to turn the tables in the last episode and actually try and make her a little more sympathetic. They did feel like they were trying to make her a little more sympathetic at the end of episode two.
Yeah.
So maybe they're going down. Maybe that is the payoff, is that they've done all these little tropes to sort of try and turn the audience against her, so they can twist it round later on. I don't know. But yeah, she's great and it's a lot of fun and she plays it well. And no, I don't think she's fat. What I'm trying to say is that they clearly are using certain factors to make the audience feel that she's overweight. And audiences don't like overweight, which is why we get these ridiculous television shows about, you know, secret fatties and what the like, so we can watch and then expose how people who are overweight haven't got high metabolisms. It's just the fact they eat too much. You know, it's a
boy with a ask for a face.
Oh yes, you know, it's all these sort of things which people like to gawk or comment on, and people don't like people who've got any weight on television, which is kind of ridiculous given that so many people on television are anorexic or underweight, and that's perfectly fine. I'm not naming any, but the amount of weather girls I've seen over the past 20-25 years on UK television and thought, I have a horrible feeling you've got an eating disorder, but you've been hired because you're thin, and you think that's perfectly fine. People don't mind that, but you know, God forbid, you know that you know you're slightly over the size of what women should be. Men can be.
Mm. Well, okay, let's move on from prey.
Bloody prey.
Well, yes, indeed. Does Doctor Who? This is exciting. Doctor Who is recording in kind of multiple places today. The southeast, they're recording Dark Eyes 3 today.
Okay.
And I don't know if they've gone to Lanzarote yet. If they haven't, they're recording in Wales. Doctor Who's going back to Lanzarote. Don't know why. Probably because it's hot. They want a holiday. It's May coming up to June. It makes sense, doesn't it? And there's been some new casting with Hermione Norris. Have I said Hermione correctly?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah. She's well known to viewers from Cold Feet, Wire in the Blood, Spooks / MI5, depending on where in the world you're from. And she's currently in this Crimson Field very badly written drama that's on BBC One at the moment about World War One, and has some bizarre things going on which seriously would not have happened, like field hospital visits from the family, that kind of thing. So she's been cast in Doctor Who. And also Tony Asoba, who was one of the Mavellans.
Yeah.
And he was in Dragonfire as well, I think. And he was in loads of TV shows in the 70s and 80s. He's also been cast in the same episode.
Cool.
I always, when I first discovered Stephen Moffat, I always thought he looked like Tony Asoba. There's a resemblance, isn't there?
Maybe he's playing Stephen Moffat.
Maybe he is. there was a report last week about Doctor Who Series 8 behind the scenes, how the BBC are very happy about things. Apparently, Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman, quote, sizzle, unquote. Now, that might be because they haven't put enough oil on in advance of their trip to Lanzarote. A BBC insider, or source on the show, told the Radio Times, he is the oldest Doctor and there is a sense he is more distanced from his assistant, more of a mystery. He is perhaps less a mate and someone she looks up to. She has to try and gauge him, but dramatically, it's very satisfying on screen. They work very well together.
Hmm. Doesn't sound like they sizzle, though, does it?
That doesn't sound anything like a barbecue or sunburn. No, you're quite right. That's not a day on the beach. But presumably there's some kind of Tom Baker, Liz Sladen bounciness there, is what they're trying to get at. I can see Jenna Coleman being able to do that.
Do Liz Sladen?
Yeah, you mean it's like in a sort of fun chemistry rather than sizzling in...
Yeah.
In,
yeah.
Well, it all depends on how they write it, though, because that like you got to remember, excuse me, when we first saw her, she seemed very much like she was going to be an Amy clone by the way she was written in Asylum of the Daleks.
Yeah.
And then she got a little bit better. She got a little different and kind of was a little bit more her own character while still kind of staying within that Moff writing of Flirtatious Companion.
I think the last two episodes have done her an enormous service, to be honest with you. The Day of the Doctor and The Time of the Doctor. As much as I would rather not have to watch The Time of the Doctor again anytime soon. Jenna was really good, and she was really good in The Day of the Doctor as well.
But I still feel a little, again, it's an era thing, I think, as well, that she is still not very well written. She's just very well played.
Yeah.
I still couldn't really sort of tell you what her motivations are or her personality really is, in the same way I couldn't particularly with Amy, but I could with Rose.
Yes.
Or I could with Donna.
Yes, yes.
And certainly, you know, with Sarah Jane. And but then, you know, like with Sarah Jane, you go back to the old characters. To a certain degree, what Jenna's doing is what they had to do, where there was a lot less characterization in the script for the classical characters, and it did a lot of the time come down to what the actors could imbue. So in some ways, she's not got any harder deal than they had. But you kind of feel that she... I still say the biggest problem is that she lacks a cohesive backstory.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to get back to the thing that she should have stayed as a governess, aren't we? So
yes, absolutely. Well,
she's the first... Excuse me. She's the only second new series companion to have followed through with regeneration.
Yes, she is, yes.
So that's going to be a nice, interesting thing to see.
And it means they can do more with her as well. They can maybe sort of like iron out some things that they maybe not... weren't too happy about with the character, because they've got less change to contrast it to.
Yeah, which is good. I mean, and you know, they did talk about that we were going to see more of the human aspect of her. So hopefully, you know, it's a good direction for the character that they were hoping to move to anyway. But also with the help of Capaldi being on scene and changing that dynamic, we'll get to just see a complete better situation all around for her. Because I said in the beginning with her, with a couple of her episodes, not Asylum, but like when she first came in, which I can't remember that one now. What the heck is that one called? But
The Snowman.
I'm thinking of her actual first one, the
Bells of St. John.
The Bells of St. John, which is probably the best of that run.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, and the thing was with her character there and a couple episodes in, certainly The Rings of Akatan, I really felt that we were starting to get a very good classic feeling companion again.
Yeah.
Like somebody who definitely was in the friend realm, somebody who was like a human being, somebody who reacted to things accordingly rather than, hey, it's danger, let's run into it. And I loved all that. They kind of started to deviate a little bit and kind of make her back to the flirtatious Amy or that kind of quippy person, but I still think she had the potential. And I think if they go back down that human route, as they're saying, I think that's going to be a great, great change. I think it's going to be very good for her because she'll get more to play on, and it'll bring back more of that classic type companion feel, especially if she's going to have a relationship where she kind of looks up to the Doctor in some kind of way. And I don't want that to sound like a negative, like these characters need someone to look up to, but rather than looking at him as like the best friend or a piece of meat or something, she's got this person that's kind of like, wow, this guy does great things. I'd like to aspire to do these things myself. And then that's how you get to see the companion grow, which I think is always a great thing to see.
I wouldn't disagree with that. Okay, well, we obviously have to wait until at least August to find out how it's all going to work out. But then again, I'm saying, oh, we've got to wait all this time. It's only 3 months away.
What about that? I did read one thing. One of the directors was saying that he believes his episodes have to get ready for a July release. Or is he just saying they have to be ready for July for an August?
Yeah, I think there are going to be some episodes ready for July simply for the television festivals and things like that.
Ah, gotcha. Right. Okay.
Because you've got the Edinburgh National Television Festival sort of July, August.
Right.
Early August sort of time. So there'll be people viewing it before it goes live at the festival and then live on screen. So it would make sense to have it ready for a couple of weeks in advance, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now that we've got a couple of things we can move on to now. Do you want to do... Do you want to do the missing episodes?
Yes, I think we should annoy people with more missing episodes.
More missing episode talk.
I was looking at a couple of clips of Doctor Who since we were talking about Doctor Who. And I was thinking back to one of the photos recently that they've put up that Karen and the kid who played the Harry Potter thing put of them on the plane with him. And Karen. And I was thinking how much better Matt Smith looks. He looks he looks like he's starting to de-age. It's as if the strain of Doctor Who is sort of going, and he's not looking quite as old anymore. Is that just me?
I kind of see what you mean. Yeah.
So if he's maybe perhaps putting on weight and
Well, maybe it's difficult to put on weight when you're doing that kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely. I say it's not a criticism. I just thought it's kind of interesting
because he's been doing a lot of cons, hasn't he? As well. So yes. He's probably sitting down a lot or lying next to the pool a lot, having eating probably more or less what he feels like, perhaps to some extent. Maybe doing a bit of exercise.
Actually, just getting a break here or there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because he was looking very gaunt by the end of his era. He was looking very gaunt indeed. Yeah.
Well, he was an old man, wasn't he, by the end?
Well, yes. I mean, there was that as well. But, you know, aside from putting on a wig, some latex, and them obviously hacking off his leg, you know, he looked thin anyway. Anyway, what were you talking about? You said something about missing episodes.
Yeah,
I'm sure people want to know more about missing episodes.
Well, yeah. Well,
They should
want to know more. And it is becoming a little bit unfortunate now. I think that's perhaps the main problem with the missing episodes thing.
Is it becoming more yummy, Christian?
When you say more yummy, what do you mean exactly?
It's like people watch EastEnders, don't they? They don't watch it for the nice, quiet life. They look for the conflict and the struggle and the drama and the tension.
Is that why people watch EastEnders?
I think so.
Poor bastards.
Mm.
That's
why I watch Neighbours.
That's why you watch Neighbours, is it?
Yeah.
Mm. Right, you don't watch Neighbours, do you?
I do, yeah.
No, you don't.
I do every day.
No, you don't.
I do. I can tell you all the storylines.
Go on, then.
What, currently?
Yeah.
Currently, they've had a big storyline with Stephen Montague coming back looking to, well, it looked like he actually killed Kate, but he probably didn't. He just kidnapped Callum, the little kid. And
okay.
They've just got him back.
We'll leave it there. James watches Neighbours.
Yeah.
Okay. So, we reported earlier today or yesterday, it all blurs into one. It was today. Ian Levine makes Omniroom a black hole personal. And obviously, there's a bit more to it than this, but the general thing is that he's a bit annoyed that so far nothing has happened beyond the release of Web of Fear and Enemy of the World. And he lays some heavy allegations on Philip Morris. He basically says, it has obviously yielded huge, massive results, but what earthly use are these results if Philip Morris, bracket, hoards them? Locked away for no one to see or enjoy or benefit from. I applaud what he did and the initiative to go out and do it, but I revile what he has done since. They should have all been given back the moment he found them, and by now they would have all been out on DVD. There's a couple of leaps of faith in there. For instance, thinking the BBC has the means to put them all on DVD and release them all at once. Don't think the BBC would have done that. The BBC wants to monetize this as much as possible. It's all getting unfortunate and messy and dirty. And this is the kind of thing that there were warnings about back in the day before we knew about anything. That this kind of... there's been a lot of swearing in today's podcast. I do apologise, dear listener, but I'm going to swear again. Shitstorm.
Right.
Is threatening or can threaten Philip Morris or the BBC or Philip Morris and BBC's relationship and put off any releases even further back. I personally think in... Levine can say what the hell he likes. It's, you know, that's the world we live in. But it does all seem to be turning into a bit of a crap fest. What do you think?
Well, there's a reason for that, isn't there, I think?
What's that?
Well, when things don't move naturally, if things are made complicated, then things become complicated. And I think, quite honestly, this is the situation.
A lack of clarity from the people involved.
I think so. I mean, again, I sit on the side that I do believe that whether one thinks that Ian should make public comments like this or not, beyond that, I think he knows a lot more than what other people do. And he's trying to sort of front that point without getting you into a point where he's actually making specific accusations.
Yeah.
And if you take those on board as potentially being accurate, given he is a man who generally has been in the know because he's been dealing with these sort of things for a long time, his accusation is that there is more material, but it is being held back for reasons which obviously he doesn't specifically disclose. And as you say, it's his opinion, and maybe you do need that. Maybe I don't know. It's a tough one, isn't it? I agree with you. I think when it starts to get negative and personal, it becomes awkward and it starts to feel very fannish. At the same time, if what he says is true and there is material being held back and it's not being disclosed, and if it's being held back for what he is suggesting, and we've got no evidence of this, obviously, for the wrong reasons, then, you know, you could say, well, why shouldn't he say something? This is his area. This is his field of expertise for the last God knows how many years, last few decades.
Well, so we don't want to get him started on Northern Soul, so let's stick to this.
So, yeah, I'm not surprised he said something. I'm not surprised. I don't think he's saying it for the wrong reason either. I don't think it's because he feels that he has been that it's because of jealousy or whatever someone might throw at him. I think there's material that he thinks is there and he feels it's being held back for the wrong reasons. And that's what he's trying to say.
Yeah. Brian?
Well, I mean, you know, we live in the time of freedom of speech and it's never been more easy than on the internet to speak how you like, regardless of your good or bad intentions. You know, I think he's perfectly free to go say whatever the heck he likes, but I do think delicate situations require delicate tact. And, you know, regardless of what he knows or what he thinks he knows, I think nobody really knows anything until it's been proven. And I think what we all need to know is, are these things out there? You know, is there something that, in fact, as a fan, is there something that we can do to help get them back to the BBC? Like, what is it if he does, if Philip Morris does have more episodes, what's the delay in getting them back to the BBC? You know, because we don't know the full story. And I think it's great news if they are out there. I think we don't know anything for sure, aside from rumors galore, and everybody getting worked up and angry about it really isn't going to help the matter. No matter what. But I mean, I do think it would be nice if somebody connected some way, somehow would say, hey, look, there may be more or there are more. We are working on it. Bear with us while we work through it. You know, this way people can have at least an idea that, OK, something's going on. They are working on it. You know, this you kind of need to appease people a little bit or else you're going to get posts like what Ian Levine did. You know, and maybe it's they don't care. Maybe, you know, it's none of our business or whatever. But I think it would just make everything go a lot easier and smoother if every once in a while, hey, here's a minor update. Sorry, it's nothing better, but still working on it. You know, just let us know. You know, it would be great because, I mean, you know, we're going to buy it no matter what. We're going to be thrilled to see them no matter what. Just throw us a bone a little bit and most of the people will calm down. Some of them won't. It's the internet. It's never going to happen fully, but you'll get a lot more people a bit more relaxed about it.
There were several occasions this year where there's supposed to have been an announcement, including the Easter. But, you know, these are just rumours. We never, you know, this isn't anything that's come from the BBC. It's just the rumours that there's going to be announcements, but they never transpired.
Yeah, well, and that's the same thing for the years that everything, you know, a quote missing episode was found and it's going to be announced. You know, how many of those things are actually some kind of insider information and how many of them are just people having fun at all of us sitting here waiting for an announcement and going, hey, let's just say there's an announcement. And I'm sure that there's also some people out there going, well, if I say there's an announcement, maybe the BBC will have to respond to it in some way. You know, like they're trying to get a reaction, trying to get a response one way or the other from the fans or from the BBC.
I suppose you could argue that for someone like Levine, maybe it becomes not so much personal, but more frustrating. Let's go on the assumption that what he suggests is correct and that there is more material there than has been disclosed and it's been held back specifically by Mr. Morris. You know, we take the whole thing, as said a few months ago, with Christopher Barry being passing away and the like of people who were involved in a lot of this old material being at an age where, you know, their time may be a little more limited than, say, yours or mine. Maybe that, in a sense, is what sort of is fueling him a little more, is if he generally believes that there is stuff being held back, not necessarily by the BBC, but by a private ownership. And this stuff is not coming out when it could be enjoyed by those who would have a vested interest in seeing it again. Maybe that's part of the frustration there, is the fact it's being held back, in his opinion, I say, because we don't know. He suggests for possibly the wrong reason, and thus not so much the fact that he doesn't get to see it or fans don't get to see it, but maybe that people who would have an interest in seeing it, who were around at the time, maybe not even necessarily those involved in the production, but just generally were loved Doctor at the time, is not able to view this material, you know, as they go on in life. It's being held back longer and longer when they should be able to see it, people like Christopher Barry, and they're not getting to see it because, as he suggests, that it's being held back for the wrong reason. So in that sort of sense, you can perhaps see why he feels legitimized in making these sort of quite vocal, I don't want to say attacks, but suggestions. Mm. I suppose they are a bit of attacks, accusations, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, they're not. You know, they're clearly they show his emotions, so they're written, I guess, emotionally well in that respect. But they're not written well enough that they kind of say, "Hey, listen, these are just my concerns. This is what is bothering me." You know, they do, and I do agree, maybe attack isn't the right word, but they do kind of come across like attacks, and you know, things maybe shouldn't be written in the heat of the moment like that, is probably just, I guess, one of my biggest issues. It's nice, and maybe he does have some really good information, and if he really wants to help the cause and so on, I just think maybe there's just a better way to go about doing it. But who knows? You know, he's probably trying other things, and these are the last minute lash out responses that he can think to do.
Or maybe it's an attempt at whistleblowing, sort of Snowden style, by sort of pushing a very, very firm accusation into the court of the other person to see if he can motivate something to happen or something to, I don't know, maybe it's not so much emotional, maybe it is tactical.
Yeah, well, I mean, Philip Morris has responded previously, hasn't he, a few weeks ago, which we mentioned, yes, on the podcast to previous earlier claims from Ian Levine. I don't think I'm alone in saying I just wish this would just all, they'd just all deal with it and sort it out and tell us what's going on, or just say there's nothing or there's something and just leave us. They haven't actually said there's nothing, have they? Officially, no. No one has said there's nothing else. The odd people who should know better have said there's nothing else. People who said that they knew nothing about the earlier ones when, in fact, they did. So if you read in any magazines or anything, people who you may think know better saying there is nothing, they have previously said there's nothing when they knew that there was something. So until someone from the BBC, and the BBC Worldwide says there is no more, this is it, we're still looking, I think we can probably assume that there is something and they're in talks.
Yeah, well, I think it's starting to sound that way. Again, as you say, if you take Ian at his word, which is, again, it's up to you. I've got no evidence to say that you should, but it's the suggestion there is, you know, people are saying, why isn't the BBC saying anything about this? But that his point would be the BBC can't because they haven't got the material back.
Yeah,
and it's in his hands, so that's why everyone is staying quiet and stum, because it's a situation where they're trying to get material back from someone they can't. That is, if you take what he says as being true, and sometimes things can be a lot more complicated than that. So I don't know, but again, I think it's worth, you know, people keep saying, why do we keep talking about this Omni rumor? But because it is something which is ongoing and it is relevant. It's probably the most relevant thing to Doctor Who so far as the whole history of the show goes than anything, even the new series. It's tangible, it's historical, and it's relevant.
And it's fascinating and intriguing at the same time.
It is as well.
Yeah. Okay. Brian Terranova, do you know your article? It wasn't your article, but your DeviantArt photograph of your TARDIS keys has proved extremely popular on Castovis.
I have noticed this.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, It's one of those things that it's weird. Like as the quote artist who made it, it's one of those things where you're both extremely happy by it, and both as well as boggled by it. And then at the same time, you sit there and you go, well, it's a shame I had an updated one in the works. Why why couldn't this have waited? You know, because like, you know, every time like I am an artist, I draw, I paint, I do all that kind of stuff aside from making prop things, just, you know, my own kind of stuff, nothing professional, just fun, my own interest. So as an artist, I always look at it, instead of looking at things going, wow, that's cool, I'm like the typical artist that looks at it and goes, my God, that's crap, why couldn't I have done this, that, or the other thing differently? And so what this was one of those things. I had gotten that photo done originally just because I wanted to an easy way to show the keys in my collection rather than just a random photo of keys. I thought that would be a fun thing to also show a bit of history. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get it done in time for the 50th anniversary. So the particular one that's going around the internet right now is my 50th anniversary celebration piece. So that's cool in a sense, because an updated one can include Capaldi and still make sense then. But it's just weird. I see it. Not long ago, it got shared on Reddit, and that made my DeviantArt explode. Then you guys, we shared it. You shared it while I was away.
Yeah.
And
it was a space filler, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. Like, after you did that.
Oh, bloody hell. I've just given you an extra DeviantArt visitor thing.
Ah,
internet.
So nice. You're so nice. No, but after you did it, Doctor Who Tumblr,
yeah,
reblogged us.
Okay.
Now this is the third time actually I've been on. Yeah, the official Doctor Who Tumblr. It's the third time I've been on there in some way. The first two times it was my David Tennant cosplaying, but this thing was like, this is nuts. This is a picture of keys that are in my collection. Like, they're keys. It's fun to me. I thought it was one of those things that was fun to me and a handful of other people. But to see it had like 10,000 notes on it.
Has it displayed on getalife.com or you sad bastard.net? No, I find it interesting. I have to ask a couple of questions.
Uh-oh, go on.
The third Doctor and the fourth Doctor is obviously a very similar key. Was there a definitively different? Because there's obviously slight alterations. If I'm looking at your DeviantArt thing, there are differences there in the actual Ankh bit at the top. So was that actually...
is that the first time anyone's ever said Ankh on the podcast?
Yeah, I think so. I'll say it again next week just to sort of dilute it a bit.
Here's the story of that particular key. Basically, in the show, John Pertwee thought, wouldn't it be fun as a gadget guy? You know, he loved gadgets, he loved cars and things as we know about him. He thought, wouldn't it be fun if I had, the Doctor had, some kind of special key for the TARDIS rather than a regular key? So the props team, the props department, decided to make one for him, or they decided within the show to make one for him, which was the key that you see there on the... for listed for him, obviously. Yeah. But it was made kind of in a rush. So if you look at the crossbars at the top, they're kind of askew or off center, or they're kind of like jagged. Mine is a replica naturally. So it wasn't made in the same way that John Pertwee's was. John Pertwee's was a couple pieces of metal that were, you know, adhered together to form the front and the back. And then all the little teeth on the front were also brazed on as well. So his was a little bit more put together piecemeal and so on. What happened was when he left the show, they gave that key to him as a gift, as a parting gift. But they took a mold of it to make Tom Baker's key. So Tom Baker's key is actually different from John Pertwee's key in the respect that it's a solid piece or two solid pieces where the teeth aren't brazed on like John Pertwee's was. What we did was the maker of these was a guy, Gary, from Mooncrest Models, which is fantastic. I do fantastic work, mooncrestmodels.com or .co.uk, excuse me. And he's just really friendly guy, really does fantastic stuff. And we spoke to him and we said, we know that these keys essentially were a mold and a model of each other. But what we can tell from looking at photos of Tom Baker, even though Tom, you know, in season one, Tom wore that key around his neck on a rather long chain, or in season 12, rather, Tom's first season. So that key got pulled and banged into things left and right. So if you actually look at close-up photos of Tom Baker, you can actually see the crossbars on the top section are actually curved downward from being pulled and bent on things so many different times. But what we can make out from the photo, it did actually look like his crossbars were symmetrical. So I guess when they took the mold, they either made a correction or just the way they got bent, it made them look that way. So our idea was, in order to have a key in our collection that kind of represented the both of them, since we couldn't actually make the key the same way that John Pertwee's was made. I know one guy trying to do it right now, but right now it hasn't happened. Rather than actually have one that's a mold of the other, we decided to actually have Gary kind of fix some of the symmetrical issues on the Tom Baker one, just to make it a little bit different for display purposes. This way, even though one was a mold of the other, we believe that they were either correct or just bashed into kind of a more corrected kind of look, even though obviously Tom Baker's, to be a bit more accurate, I really should be bending those bars down completely out of shape. But that's why they're slightly different when you see them there. We asked Gary specifically to make a slight change on it just so that in our collection, it could be a little bit more of an idealized prop. And that's what you do in the prop world sometimes. Rather than going for 100% accuracy, which in some cases, if you ever see a prop used in a TV show up close, sometimes it's complete crap because it only has to look good enough to fool the camera. It doesn't have to look great to fool your eye. You know, and some of these props on screen look so amazing, but when you see them, they just look like they're made of like, you know, electrical tape, bits of cardboard and a Dixie cup. You know, it's really ridiculous. But some things we have to idealize. And in this case, it was just a way to kind of differentiate them a little bit and kind of put that our own canon kind of theme to why his key was bent a little bit differently.
Or you could have just said, yes, James, they are different keys.
Well, you know, honestly, in a sense, James, they are different keys, but that's the reason why they are different keys. There you go.
Okay. Well, you know, I was going to get onto, I was going to go to the figurines via this, but something just came to mind.
Yeah.
Do you know Paul McGann's cat, Brian?
I don't know him personally.
No, he doesn't like you.
Oh, that's terrible.
We've recently, you may or may not know this, dear listener, we've recently introduced a comments policy on Castovers, which sounds like an enormously official way of telling people to be nice to each other, but that's essentially what it is. And Paul McGann's cat suggested that we might have done this because we weren't very happy with him not liking Brian. Or her not liking Brian. There's a comment earlier, back when you went to the Awesome Con Hits Washington This Easter article. Who wrote this? Was it Jonathan? Yeah, Jonathan wrote this and said, basically opened it saying, well, he didn't open it, but there's a phrase in it that says, if you just can't get enough of Brian, head to ZenkaiCon at the Lancaster County Convention Center, Lancaster, PA, on April 26th. And Paul McGann's cat quoted this, just can't get enough of Brian. And then he goes on, is anyone actually saying that? No offense to Mr. Turnover, but he doesn't resemble Tennant one bit, and I'm not really sure why this site keeps plugging him. To which I replied, to his first section, just can't get enough of Brian. Is anyone actually saying that? And I said, believe us, it came as a shock here too. And he then says, no offense to Mr. Turnover, but he doesn't resemble Tennant one bit. And I said, he isn't supposed to. It's cosplay, not looky likey. So, yeah.
Well, that told me, didn't it?
Right.
God. Next time I'll use my own name. I won't bother these stupid accounts.
Well, you know, honestly, that's once again the thing with the internet. It's so easy to make comments like that when you're faceless. However, in person, people will say these things, and it's cool. You know, people kind of do miss the whole point of the whole costuming or cosplay thing.
Yeah.
But it's cool. Everybody can have their opinion. I don't care, but I do find that funny.
Okay, let's now listen. Figures, Doctor Who figures, went up their own arse, didn't they? Recently, I say recently. That's probably not the last year. Was it last year? Or was it the year before? Now I'm losing track of time. When the 3.75-inch figurines were introduced under the auspices of "You can play with them with your Star Wars figures now," So. Brian Terranova, you're the one of us three who has a lot of the old 5-inch figures, are you not?
I am.
Are you excited by the possibility of the end of the 3.75-inch range? Does it fill your bank balance with dread?
There's kind of that, to be honest. I think I mentioned on here before, I never really wanted to actually collect the toys. I bought like one or two just as like a little fun thing for the shelf. And then somebody gifted me an entire box full of them and started the whole downhill slide from there. But I do really enjoy them. I just picked up the War Doctor, or if they want to call him the Other Doctor, whatever you want to call him. I just picked him up. I picked up a Emperor's Dalek and Emperor's Guard Dalek and Christopher Eccleston set because I previously had to make that one for my collection. Yes, I'm one of those guys who does that thing. And I was sad when they went to the 3.5 range, because how would you then have a complete set of Doctors? You know, if you were a collector to that thing I thought maybe one day just even having Doctors and Daleks on the shelf would be cool, but how will I do that without a Capaldi, you know? But they made the Other Doctor, which I was like, okay, well, that's kind of cool. They got him in there. Maybe they'll do this. But it did seem rather hopeless. So I think it's a nice change because so many people invested so much money into this, whether it's kids or collectors, to have, you know, like if you want to play, use a Capaldi figure with your Other Doctors, and he's just got to be, a midget in comparison. That would be rather sad. Yet at the same time, I don't think kids care in the way that we do, because my nephew will play with, you know, a plastic figure of Spider-Man that is molded completely solidly. He does not have any, movable appendages, and he's maybe like, 3 inches tall. And he'll use him with his Batman figure that's maybe like 2 inches taller and has complete, like, you know, very cool articulation. And he just doesn't care. He's five. You know, he uses them because all he knows is, I've got Spider-Man, I've got Batman, they're all fighting together, this is cool. You know, and it's a neat thing for someone like me to be able to complete the collection, have it look nice on a shelf. But for kids, it doesn't really matter. So, you know, and that's their toys. That's where they're for. That's who they're for. I don't really care. When they switched, it was kind of one of those, that's a bummer, but it's not the end of the world things for me. I'm happy now because I may be able to get a complete set of Doctors if this is indeed a truthful thing. But at the end of the day, I really just don't think it matters.
Okay. Well, we've heard that there may be a couple of 5-inch Dalek sets coming out. Have you heard anything different?
I haven't, no. I mean, I heard that rumor as well. But the thing is, though, they've been doing... Even though they switched to the 3.5 range, rather, they did not stop the 5-inch range or the 6-inch range altogether. They had been releasing random figures here or there, or sets, you know, and certainly more often than not, it was classic related. So I'm not surprised, because Daleks sell well, and people will want them for their collections. And they did just come out not long ago. Like I said, I just got that Eccleston set. That was not really it's maybe a year now or so. It just finally got to the US, but it's not really an older set. It's just another set that they're making use of the molds that they have and still releasing figures within this range. But clearly the War Doctor was a new figure made specifically for that range.
Okay.
So they never really fully got rid of it. Maybe they're just doing random updates to it.
Yeah, maybe. I suspect if these Asylum of the Daleks sets do well, I reckon they may well do a Day of the Doctor Daleks.
Oh, yeah, I would think so for sure. I mean, pretty much as long as there's interest, they will find something else that can go within that range. And still with Alistair Dewar in charge of the toy line. I mean, he's great. He's got a great sense of what fans like. He's a fan himself. So he knows exactly like what we would want or where his own interests lie. And once in a blue moon, we differ, which one of them being he prefers Sylvester McCoy without the hat. You know, what can you do? He at least gave us both versions. I think it's in good hands. But I do think that what they were saying with the ranges and size making sense, you know, it's a lot easier to buy your kids toys that cost about $12 versus like some of those. So I had to pay for that Dalek set, a Dalek and the Ninth Doctor. I had to pay around $50. You know, that's not exactly very kid friendly,
no,
or at least family friendly for a kid, you know, so I do get the scale change, and it makes a lot of sense. And honestly, if they're both selling, I don't see an issue why you can't sell them in both ranges to the people who want to buy the sizes they want to buy. But the classic figures were always more of a collector's thing anyway. Kids bought them because some of them really wanted them, but they were definitely sold in much more limited numbers than the other stuff.
Okay. James, yeah. You've got a few, haven't you?
No, I haven't got any.
Oh, I haven't not got any? I thought you had a figure.
No,
or
I wouldn't. I
you've
I
got
would.
Daleks then? Have you got Daleks?
No, not police got box. Daleks. The only thing I've got is the police box, which right. was 5-inch range, wasn't it? Yeah, I've got nothing else. The Daleks look quite nice, actually. I mean, the ones on the image, the 5-inch things, they look quite nicely done.
Yeah, they've done a real good job with their Daleks.
You could almost have one of those on by your computer desk, and it would look quite nice. You know, it's when it gets to that sort of detail. I think things like Daleks and police boxes work very well in these sort of ranges, especially for adults, because figures. I mean, I've seen a couple on Flickr. Some people do some really good stuff with those figures. They do some. They sort of, I've seen them actually build the props around it, like the police box, like Baker's police box, which is far better than the one that's on sale, and you can actually do some very nice little setup scenes. But I think the actual ones which aren't organic work very nicely as things that you can put on your desk, and that those Daleks especially, and you know, police boxes if they're done well. Are things which I think really work. So for 5-inch, I think they're better. As a kid, I would have probably wanted them in the at the same height as Star Wars. I understand what Brian's saying, and at about sort of 4 or 5, I probably wouldn't have cared. But by the time I was 7, 6 or 7, I would like to have them the same size. So yeah, I can see the logic there. I can see the logic. And also, the smaller the figures, the more likely you are to get decentish props. I mean, with, you know, like the 5-inch range, it took ages before a police box came out. You know, it was ages. While, you know, if they're smaller, these sort of those sort of proppy things tend to sort of seem to enter ranges far quicker. So there's always that sort of thing. I don't know, but I'm not a big toy guy. They just take up space.
Well, that was a huge thing. Like number one, they take up space. Number two, you realize how much money you spent on these toys. And it's part of it was like that childhood thing where like I didn't grow up with Doctor Who toys. You know, we didn't have the Daypool toys here until much later. You know, they and even then you had to find them in like specialty shops that, you know, had them imported in or whatever. So for me, it was kind of like, wow, you know, I've just always kind of wanted these things. I think I'll pick up a Doctor and a TARDIS and a Dalek. That would be cool. You know, and it was just going to be like a fun little item on the shelf for me or on my desk, as you said, you know. And then after a while, after I was gifted that box and kind of realized, well, I can complete the set, you know. After a while, it really just kind of became, oh, wow, they made this guy. That guy's awesome. I need that too. Oh, I need this. I need that. And I need to complete this set now. And it was just really, really ridiculous. It really piled up, and they look really nice on the shelf. Like I had a dedicated shelf to them, but at the same time, you really couldn't do anything with them, because if you tried to touch one, they would fall down like dominoes. And so they pretty much just sat there and collected dust. So for me, I still want to have a complete set of Doctors at least, and I would like to complete the companions that they make. So my new goal is Doctors, companions, and Russell T. Davis era Daleks, which is why I picked up that.
Russell T. Davis was one of the character figures.
I would love
wanted.
A Russell T. Davis.
That would be cool, wouldn't it?
Production team figures. Why have they never done that?
I know. I mean, he could be there. He could have a little cigarette in his hand. You pull a little thing at the back and it sort of rushes up to his mouth backwards and forth.
Totally. You could have a little Stephen Moffat with sort of microphone hair. And then you could have a John Nathan Turner in his Hawaii shirt. And then you could have a fight between the two.
Different shirts, you can swap them as well. Maybe.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
They could have hair.
Colin
fights,
Baker with a beard.
Nathan Turner's could be all really curly in that sort of light way, and then, you know, Moffat's could be fizzy, and you could sort of rub them against each other, and that'd be how
stick
they'd fight it out. Or stick them to walls, yes. Yeah, I mean, production tea would be fun.
I know people would buy them, certain collectors would definitely buy them.
I think the problem is that a lot of people would buy them and then burn them, and then obviously photo them on Flickr and Facebook with them being burned.
Would it be rude? I think it would be rude, but I think I'm going to have to say it anyway. Now, you could have a Russell T. Davies and Julie Gardner twin set with just one figure and then a wig.
Ooh.
Ooh, yeah. I can't unsay it now. Okay, let's move on.
Oh, yeah. But I was thinking you could have, just to take you away from your little weird point, you kind of like, you could have like Stephen Moffat's face, and you could do the Kane thing from Dragonfire. And just melt it, couldn't you? Yeah, that's what people would do, wouldn't they? And then they'd post on internet, so you can see why those production figures aren't there.
Oh, that would be good.
Because you could do it like he opens a screen like in Dragonfire, but underneath it just shows flagging ratings or something, and his face melts. And no, not that the ratings are flagging. I'm just trying to be satirical, but I'm failing rather abysmally.
Oh, this is good stuff. Sadly, we have to move on to recommendations, boys. Have you both got recommendations this week?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I have as well. I've got a couple. So my first is the Wit and Wisdom and timey-wimey stuff. The Quotable Doctor Who by Cavan Scott and Mark Wright, which is out soon. And I have received a preview copy of it. And it's really good. It's out on the 22nd of May, so that's next Tuesday. It's a hardback. It's £12.99 here in the UK. It's a, what we're looking at there, 340-odd pages, and it's full of quotes. I'm just going to pull one out randomly. They're all separated up into different sections. Life in some form will always go on, from the Mutants. They're kind of thematically grouped. And here's one. If all else fails, Jamie and the Doctor... Have you thought up some clever plan, Doctor? Yes, Jamie, I believe I have. What are you going to do? Bung a rock at it. So, yeah, it's good. It's not just a Doctor, as you can see. There's a few conversations with his companions in there. As non-fiction Doctor Who books go, this is one of the best ones that's come along for a long time. It's a handy little reference. Nice bit of conversation piece if you want to throw it on the coffee table. And it's got a nice shiny silver and matte black design cover as well. I recommend you get that. Dear listener. And as James has already mentioned Prey, and I suspect he may mention it again in a few moments' time.
Bugger.
I am going to suggest Penny Dreadful, which also starts next Tuesday on Sky Atlantic, which is a kind of... it's by Sam Mendes and the director, who was the director of Skyfall, and his Skyfall co-writer, whose name escapes me at the moment. There's people like Timothy Dalton, Billy Piper... Helen McCrory, and you know, if you're aware of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, you'll know that it's made up of lots of fictional characters, and Penny Dreadful's kind of similar in that respect, but it's, you know, all done in a very different way. And it's kind of Victoriana horror, is the best description of it that I can ascertain at the moment. It looks really, really promising. So I believe it may have started in the US already, but it starts.
It has,
in the, yeah. Have you caught it?
I haven't, but I've seen a bunch of friends talking about it. Yeah.
Okay. Positive?
Yeah,
right. Yeah, cool. Okay, so they're my recommendations. Brian.
Brian, what do you think? Oh, me. Mine is actually, I'm going to go back to the missing episodes and say I got the DVDs here for Enemy of the World and The Web of Fear. And there's no extras, as we knew, but it's quite a different experience watching them on DVD versus watching the iTunes downloads, because the picture quality is a lot better. I didn't expect it to be too tremendously different, considering I know you can get high def movies on iTunes. So I had thought just, you know, the episodes were just going to be the same kind of files there. But I think there was, for certainly with Web of Fear, I think there were some scenes that were vidfired that were not, because apparently the iTunes downloads don't do the vidfire very well, or they can't accommodate it somehow, some way. So when you're watching Web of Fear, the picture quality is very different in a lot of places than the iTunes broadcast. So it was nice to have the DVDs, aside from the fact that, you know, on the shelf, yet again, they fill out the collection. They give Troughton much more of a nice space to fill in, which is great. But they're nice DVDs. You know, it is a shame they're so extra light, but the feature is so worth it. I really don't miss it. So I definitely would recommend picking up both of them on DVD if you have not done so already. Although it's kind of funny, in the US, they released Web of Fear first, and we got Enemy of the World after that. And in the UK, it was different, but we got the same releases. So on Web of Fear, you have a... also available trailer for the Enemy of the World, which doesn't make sense because we didn't have it yet. And when you get the Enemy of the World, you have a coming soon trailer for the Web of Fear. So it's kind of a bit timey-wimey there as well for you American collectors if you want to buy them in that out-of-order order. Silly, I know, but it was fun for me.
Okay. That other fella, McLean.
I've not really got anything, really, because we sort of really chatted about Prey early on, which I would still say, if you've not watched it, it's and you're in the UK, it's on ITV Player still for the first two parts. It's only three parts, so it's a nice, easy thing to jump into and enjoy. But yeah, I think that's it for me, really.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, I don't think we've got anything else to add. I'm sure, the listener, that you will join us with our sympathies to Paul Spragg's family and his Big Finish colleagues. Paul was a really friendly chap at Big Finish. He's really helpful to websites like ourselves.
Yeah.
Always with a and fans as well. Always with a cheerful message, email, and very, very helpful. He sadly passed away last week. So that's probably going to leave a bit of a hole at Big Finish for a while. That does bring us to the end of this week's podcast with a K. So until next time, goodbye.